distinctly felt wave of divine presence. No one spoke for a while. Mr. Maxwell, standing there where the faces lifted their intense gaze into his, felt what he had already felt, a strange setting back out of the 19th century into the first, when the disciples had all things in common and a spirit of fellowship must have flowed freely between them, such as the First Church of Raymond had never before known. How much has his church membership known of this fellowship and daily interest before this little company had begun to do as they believed Jesus would do? It was with difficulty that he thought of his present age and surroundings. The same thought was present with all the rest also. There was an unspoken comradeship such as they had never known. It was present with them while Virginia was speaking and during the silence that followed. If it had been defined by any of them, it would perhaps have taken some such shape as this. If I shall, in the course of my obedience to my promise, meet with loss or trouble in the world, I can depend upon the genuine practical sympathy and fellowship of any other Christian in this room who has, with me, made the pledge to do all things by the rule, what would Jesus do? All this, the distinct wave of spiritual power emphasized. It had the effect that a physical miracle may have had on the early disciples in giving them a feeling of confidence in the Lord that helped them to face loss and martyrdom with courage and even joy. Before they went away this time, there were several confidences, like those of Edward Norman's. Some of the young men told of loss of places owing to their honest obedience to their promise. Alexander Powers spoke briefly of the fact that the commission had promised to take action on his evidence at the earliest date possible. Chapter 14. But more than any other feeling at this meeting rose the tide of fellowship for one another. Maxwell watched it, trembling for its climax, which he knew was not yet reached. When it was, where would it lead them? He did not know, but he was not unduly alarmed about it. Only he watched with growing wonder the result of that simple promise as it was being obeyed in these various lives. Those results were already being felt all over the city. Who could measure their influence at the end of a year? One practical form of this fellowship showed itself in the assurances which Edward Norman received of support for his paper. There was a general flocking toward him when the meeting closed, and the response to his appeal for help from the Christian disciples in Raymond was fully understood by this little company. The value of such a paper in the homes and in behalf of good citizenship, especially at the present crisis in the city, could not be measured. It remained to be seen what could be done now that the paper was endowed so liberally. But it still was true, as Norman insisted, that money alone could not make the paper a power. It must receive the support and sympathy of the Christians in Raymond before it could be counted on as one of the great forces of the city. The week that followed this Sunday meeting was one of great excitement in Raymond. It was the week of the election. President Marsh, true to his promise, took up his cross and bore it manfully, but with shuddering, with groans and even tears, for his deepest conviction was touched, and he tore himself out of the scholarly seclusion of years with a pain and anguish that cost him more than anything he had ever done as a follower of Christ. With him were a few of the college professors who had made the pledge in the First Church. Their experience and suffering were the same as his, for their isolation from all the duties of citizenship had been the same. The same was also true of Henry Maxwell, who plunged into the horror of this fight against whiskey and its allies with a sickening dread of each day's new encounter with it, for never before had he borne such a cross. He staggered under it, and in the brief intervals when he came in from the work and sought the quiet of his study for rest, the sweat broke out on his forehead, and he felt the actual terror of one who marches into unseen, unknown horrors. Looking back on it afterwards, he was amazed at his experience. He was not a coward, but he felt the dread that any man of his habits feels when confronted suddenly with a duty which carries with it the doing of certain things so unfamiliar that the actual details connected with it betray his ignorance and fill him with the shame of humiliation. When Saturday, the election day, came, the excitement rose to its height. An attempt was made to close all the saloons. It was only partly successful. There was a great deal of drinking going on all day. The rectangle boiled and heaved and cursed and turned its wrong side out to the gaze of the city. Gray had continued his meetings during the week, and the results had been even greater than he had dared to hope. When Saturday came, it seemed to him that the crisis in his work had been reached. The Holy Spirit and the Satan of rum seemed to rouse up to a desperate conflict. The more interest in the meetings, the more ferocity and vileness outside. The saloon men no longer concealed their feelings. Open threats of violence were made. Once during the week, Gray and his little company of helpers were assailed with missiles of various kinds as they left the tent late at night. The police sent down a special force, and Virginia and Rachel were always under the protection of either Rollin or Dr. West. Rachel's power in song had not diminished. Rather, with each night, it seemed to add to the intensity and reality of the Spirit's presence. Gray had at first hesitated about having a meeting that night, but he had a simple rule of action and was always guided by it. The Spirit seemed to lead him to continue the meeting, and so Saturday night he went on as usual. The excitement all over the city had reached its climax when the polls closed at 6 o'clock. Never before had there been such a contest in Raymond. The issue of license or no license had never been an issue under such circumstances. Never before had such elements in the city been arrayed against each other. It was an unheard-of thing that the president of Lincoln College, the pastor of the First Church, the dean of the cathedral, the professional men living in fine houses on the boulevard, should come personally into the wards and by their presence and their example represent the Christian conscience of the place. The ward politicians were astonished at the sight. However, their astonishment did not prevent their activity. The fight grew hotter every hour, and when 6 o'clock came, neither side could have guessed at the result with any certainty. Everyone agreed that never before had there been such an election in Raymond, and both sides awaited the announcement of the result with the greatest interest. It was after 10 o'clock when the meeting at the tent was closed. It had been a strange and in some respects a remarkable meeting. Maxwell had come down again at Gray's request. He was completely worn out by the day's work, but the appeal from Gray came to him in such a form that he did not feel able to resist it. President Marsh was also present. He had never been to the rectangle, and his curiosity was aroused from what he had noticed of the influence of the evangelist in the worst part of the city. Dr. West and Rollin had come with Rachel and Virginia, and Lorene, who still stayed with Virginia, was present near the organ, in her right mind, sober, with a humility and dread of herself that kept her as close to Virginia as a faithful dog. All through the service she sat with bowed head, weeping a part of the time, sobbing when Rachel sang the song, "I Was a Wandering Sheep," clinging with almost visible, tangible yearning to the one hope she had found, listening to prayer and appeal and confession all about her, like one who was a part of a new creation, yet fearful for her right to share in it fully. The tent had been crowded. As on some other occasions, there was more or less disturbance on the outside. This was increased as the night advanced, and Gray thought it wise not to prolong the service. Once in a while, a shout as from a large crowd swept into the tent. The returns from the election were beginning to come in, and the rectangle had emptied every lodging house, den, and hovel into the streets. In spite of these distractions, Rachel's singing kept the crowd in the tent from dissolving. There were a dozen or more conversions. Finally, the people became restless, and Gray closed the service, remaining a little while with the converts. Rachel, Virginia, Lorene, Rollin, and the doctor, President Marsh, Mr. Maxwell, and Dr. West went out together, intending to go down to the usual waiting place for their car. As they came out of the tent, they were at once aware that the rectangle was trembling on the verge of a drunken riot, and as they pushed through the gathering mobs in the narrow streets, they began to realize that they themselves were objects of great attention. "There he is, the bloke in the tall hat. He's the leader," shouted a rough voice. President Marsh, with his erect commanding figure, was conspicuous in the little company. "How has the election gone? It is too early to know the result yet, isn't it?" He asked the question aloud, and a man answered. "They say second and third wards have gone almost solid for no license. If that is so, the whiskey men have been beaten." "Thank God. I hope it is true," exclaimed Maxwell. "Marsh, we are in danger here. Do you realize our situation? We ought to get the ladies to a place of safety." "That is true," said Marsh gravely. At that moment, a shower of stones and other missiles fell over them. The narrow street and sidewalk in front of them was completely choked with the worst elements of the rectangle. "This looks serious," said Maxwell. With Marsh and Rollin and Dr. West, he started to go forward through a small opening, Virginia, Rachel, and Lorene following close and sheltered by the men, who now realized something of their danger. The rectangle was drunk and enraged. It saw in Marsh and Maxwell two of the leaders in the election contest, which had perhaps robbed them of their beloved saloon. "Down with the aristocrats," shouted a shrill voice, more like a woman's than a man's. A shower of mud and stones followed. Rachel remembered afterwards that Rollin jumped directly in front of her and received on his head and chest a number of blows that would probably have struck her if he had not shielded her from them. And just then, before the police reached them, Lorene started forward in front of Virginia and pushed her aside, looking up and screaming. It was so sudden that no one had time to catch the face of the one who did it. But out of the upper window of a room over the very saloon where Lorene had come out a week before, someone had thrown a heavy bottle. It struck Lorene on the head, and she fell to the ground. Virginia turned and instantly kneeled down by her. The police officers by that time had reached the little company. President Marsh raised his arm and shouted over the howl that was beginning to rise from the wild beast in the mob. "Stop! You've killed a woman!" The announcement partly sobered the crowd. "Is it true?" Maxwell said, as Dr. West kneeled on the other side of Lorene, supporting her. "She's dying," said Dr. West briefly. Lorene opened her eyes and smiled at Virginia, who wiped the blood from her face, and then bent over and kissed her. Lorene smiled again, and the next minute her soul was in paradise. Chapter 15. "He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness." The body of Lorene lay in state at the Page Mansion on the avenue. It was Sunday morning, and the clear, sweet spring air, just beginning to breathe over the city the perfume of early blossoms in the woods and fields, swept over the casket from one of the open windows at the end of the grand hall. The church bells were ringing, and people on the avenue going by to service turned curious, inquiring looks up at the great house, and then went on, talking of the recent events which had so strangely entered into and made history in the city. At the first church, Mr. Maxwell, bearing on his face marks of the scene he had been through, confronted an immense congregation, and spoke to it with a passion and a power that came so naturally out of the profound experiences of the day before that his people felt for him something of the old feeling of pride they once had in this dramatic delivery. Only this was with a different attitude, and all through his impassioned appeal this morning, there was a note of sadness and rebuke and stern condemnation that made many of the members pale with self-accusation or with inward anger. For Raymond had awakened that morning to the fact that the city had gone for license after all. The rumor at the rectangle that the second and third wards had gone no license proved to be false. It was true that the victory was won by a very meager majority, but the result was the same as if it had been overwhelming. Raymond had voted to continue for another year the saloon. The Christians of Raymond stood condemned by the result. More than 100 professing Christian disciples had failed to go to the polls, and many more than that number had voted with the whiskey men. If all the church members of Raymond had voted against the saloon, it would today be outlawed instead of crowned king of the municipality. For that had been the fact in Raymond for years. The saloon ruled. No one denied that. What would Jesus do? And this woman who had been brutally struck down by the very hand that had assisted so eagerly to work her earthly ruin, what of her? Was it anything more than the logical sequence of the whole horrible system of license that for another year the very saloon that received her so often encompassed her degradation, from whose very spot the weapon had been hurled that struck her dead, would, by the law which the Christian people of Raymond voted to support, perhaps open its doors tomorrow and damn 100 Lorenes before the year had drawn to its bloody close? All this, with a voice that rang and trembled and broke in sobs of anguish for the result, did Henry Maxwell pour out upon his people that Sunday morning. And men and women wept as he spoke. President Marsh sat there, his usual erect, handsome, firm, bright, self-confident bearing all gone, his head bowed upon his breast, the great tears rolling down his cheeks, unmindful of the fact that never before had he shown outward emotion in a public service. Edward Norman, nearby, sat with his clear-cut, keen face erect, but his lip trembled and he clutched the end of the pew with a feeling of emotion that struck deep into his knowledge of the truth as Maxwell spoke it. No man had given or suffered more to influence public opinion that week than Norman. The thought that the Christian conscience had been aroused too late or too feebly lay with a weight of accusation upon the heart of the editor. What if he had begun to do as Jesus would have done long ago? Who could tell what might have been accomplished by this time? And up in the choir, Rachel Winslow, with her face bowed on the railing of the oak screen, gave way to a feeling which she had not allowed yet to master her. But it so unfitted her for her part that when Mr. Maxwell finished, and she tried to sing the closing solo after the prayer, her voice broke, and for the first time in her life, she was obliged to sit down, sobbing, and unable to go on. Over the church in the silence that followed this strange scene, sobs and the noise of weeping arose. When had the first church yielded to such a baptism of tears? What had become of its regular, precise, conventional order of service, undisturbed by any vulgar emotion and unmoved by any foolish excitement? But the people had lately had their deepest convictions touched. They had been living so long on their surface feelings that they had almost forgotten the deeper wells of life. Now that they had broken the surface, the people were convicted of the meaning of their discipleship. Mr. Maxwell did not ask, this morning, for volunteers to join those who had already pledged to do as Jesus would. But when the congregation had finally gone, and he had entered the lecture room, it needed but a glance to show him that the original company of followers had been largely increased. The meeting was tender. It glowed with the Spirit's presence. It was alive with strong and lasting resolve to begin a war on the whiskey power in Raymond that would break its reign forever. Since the first Sunday when the first company of volunteers had pledged themselves to do as Jesus would do, the different meetings had been characterized by distinct impulses or impressions. Today, the entire force of the gathering seemed to be directed to this one large purpose. It was a meeting full of broken prayers of contrition, of confession, of strong yearning for a new and better city life. And all through it ran one general cry for deliverance from the saloon and its awful curse. But if the first church was deeply stirred by the events of the last week, the rectangle also felt moved strangely in its own way. The death of Lorene was not in itself so remarkable a fact. It was her recent acquaintance with the people from the city that lifted her into special prominence and surrounded her death with more than ordinary importance. Everyone in the rectangle knew that Lorene was at this moment lying in the Page Mansion up on the avenue. Exaggerated reports of the magnificence of the casket had already furnished material for eager gossip. The rectangle was excited to know the details of the funeral. Would it be public? What did Miss Page intend to do? The rectangle had never before mingled even in this distant personal manner with the aristocracy on the boulevard. The opportunities for doing so were not frequent. Gray and his wife were besieged by inquirers who wanted to know what Lorene's friends and acquaintances were expected to do in paying their last respects to her, for her acquaintance was large and many of the recent converts were among her friends. So that is how it happened that Monday afternoon at the tent, the funeral service of Lorene was held before an immense audience that choked the tent and overflowed beyond all previous bounds.